I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ihr hört Gedankensalat, der ultimative Podcast mit Delal und Erwa.
Salam!
Welcome back
to a special episode of Gedankensalat!
Yes, it's been a long time, we're sorry for that. And this is a special episode because it's gonna be in English. Yes. So prepare yourselves for that. And I'm gonna tell you why. It is about an international topic, right? Hot yeah. topic we're gonna discuss with four different guests this time. Guys, say hello quickly.
Hello.
Hello.
We are all over the world, like from Berlin to Bielefeld to Esma. Where are you located right now?
Sarajevo.
Oh yeah. Okay. So
and
we're all
too.
Not. Oh, sorry, Armin. I again completely forgot about you. You can introduce yourselves in a minute. We will just quickly present the topic, I guess. We already mentioned it's going to be something really important with globally impacted a lot of it made a huge wave on Instagram 2 weeks ago, I think, right?
And I think you all heard about it. So 2 weeks ago, Halima Aden posted a story and it was like, oh my God, did you see her story? Yeah. She quitted her model job. Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
Everyone was talking about it, basically. My whole friends.
Our friend group.
Yes, all the people on Instagram. And even big magazines and newspapers were writing about it, how she canceled the fashion world and is quitting modeling.
Yeah.
And I think... now it's time to introduce yourselves, guys. You can just, we'll start with you and then you go around. Just quickly introduce yourself, saying your name, your age, where you come from. So the people, because it's the first time having so many guests on here, they can get to, how do you say that? Get to know your voices, I guess. Yeah. Okay. We're really glad to have you here, by the way. It's such an honor that you're part of this.
Thank you so much.
And it makes us really happy.
Hi and salam. Seriously, it's an honor to be with you guys. You know, I admire your work a lot. And my name is Armin Bigic. I'm 29 years old and I'm studying Islamic theology and gender studies. Yeah. And I'm glad to be here with you today, guys. And discuss some controversial topics.
And Esma, you can introduce yourself now.
Yes. Hi, salam. I'm Esma Latic. I'm a 26-year-old Muslim woman. I got my BA and MA in English language and literature and my second MA in human rights and democracy. And I was born in and live in Bosnia and Herzegovina in Sarajevo.
Nice.
And hi, I'm Beza, and I study English philology and political science at the Freie University in Berlin, and I'm 27 years old.
Salam, my name is Senadin, I'm 30 years old, and I'm currently doing my master's in statistics in Berlin, and that's basically it.
Awesome, thank you all for being here, taking the time for recording this episode. It will be great fun, and it's a big pleasure for us to have you here.
Would you like to sum up the topic and why we are meeting now here? And you can sum up.
Well, we all saw Halima Aden's story, where she was posting her issues with the fashion industry and how she felt deprived of the right to express herself as a hijabi and stick to certain ethical standards that she believes in and sticks to. And we all saw the story, and we all had interaction with people in our environments, and we were quite surprised that not many people understood our perspective on the story. And I especially was astonished when I just posted on Instagram the question, are there any people out finding Halima Aden's story also problematic? And I got a huge echo of responses, completely different responses. There are certain people like saying like, yeah, problematic as fuck, please elaborate. Can you tell me what your perspective is? I felt completely alone. While just some people were triggered by the fact that I, as a Muslim man, or in general, was asking the questions and were starting to attack me like, oh, how can you even say this? Like, nobody wants to have your opinion. And then we came together in a conversation with in a group of people where we realized like, whoa, like people didn't seem to understand the point where we're coming from and the criticism we raised. And we felt that the discussion was taken in a very one-dimensional direction. And then afterwards, we started spontaneously having a WhatsApp call where we realized like, actually, we need to do an episode on it because we believe the opinions we're having, they have a validation, they are important, and they need to be shared.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It was really like ups and downs and very like a lot of pros and cons and against and like for. And yeah, we came here to discuss the whole topic. And maybe Esma, you want to start with your first impression. What idea or what like opinion did you have when you saw the story for the first time? What did you think?
Yeah, well, when I saw it first, I had some questions raised similar to what Armin mentioned. But nevertheless, like my overall impression is that what she did was an act of courage and that she opened a whole new discursive and let's say cognitive space by rejecting to compromise her values, beliefs, her authenticity as a Black Muslim woman for the sake of complying, which is often expected from women, I think particularly from women belonging to minorities. So in that sense, I admire and applaud her courage to prioritize herself, her beliefs, her relationship with God over the comfort or benefits she had been receiving and could have kept earning by complying to whatever the social norms were being imposed upon her. However, within the Muslim community, I think that her posts do or actually should raise a couple of important points of discussion. And that is, in my view, the way she discursively constructed, whether she did that intentionally or not, the concept of hijab is a very clearly defined, fixed construct. I'm emphasizing that this part, she did so intentionally or not, we do not know that. And for me, it's not Halima to herself to blame for whatever the normativity perhaps she imposed through her story. But that is another set of arguments I can perhaps come back to later. But what I find concerning was the discussion that followed, which lacked a proper, in my opinion, reflection on the way she talked about the rights and wrongs of wearing a hijab. Like, this is the way you should do it. This is not the way you should do it. As a Muslim woman who does not wear a headscarf myself, but I claim to be wearing, observing hijab, I was a bit disappointed with the simplification of her story into something of a merely women empowering personal journey without references to the problematic implications that were involved in her story. But it is, yes, that is, I think, symptomatic of the Muslim community across the globe, that we often like to simplify the discourse into, this is right, this is wrong, this is how you go to Jannah, this is how you don't. And in that sense, I think the lack of critical reflection was what I found very problematic. But in the discussion that followed, primarily, not necessarily in Halima's story itself. Mm. So yeah, those are some of my basic thoughts.
We can just add to that by saying, like, by having a little disclaimer right here, this is not an episode about, like, canceling Halima or like hating her, bashing her, absolutely not. We just found that this, her story or the following discussion, as you mentioned, it just, once again showcased how like problematic the discussion in the Muslim community can be. Mm-hmm. And so we just want to talk about that, having, this as like kicking it all off. Yeah. Beyza Senadin, you want to just, maybe add to that. What was your first thoughts about this? How did you react seeing that story?
She mentioned that it's a personal story, or like a person. Yeah, it's a personal story, which is completely fine. She can. I don't have anything against it. It's her choice, and as you already said, Esma, I think it was also good that she spoke about it. But throughout the story, or throughout the slides, I got this feeling that it was not personal anymore. It was not about her own experience. This is what I received, but not only me, also other people. That it's about what is right and what is wrong. That she has like a fixed, as you already mentioned, a fixed point of view. Like, okay, this is how it should be. And there were, for example, some slides where she was fully covered. You couldn't see her neck. You couldn't see anything, like to most Islamic views, or like a lot of Islamic views should be like, that's completely fine. But the way how she presented and was not okay with her. And then you saw other pictures where she had no makeup at all. And she had like more like a traditional kind of headscarf. You saw that she was fine with that. And she said, yeah, that on this slide, I was on, or on this picture, I was back on the track. And this is what I was thinking was that all Muslims, it doesn't matter where, we're kind of like affected by a specific, I think like a specific indoctrination, I would say like that, like this Salafi kind of influence. I wouldn't say like per se in her stories, but I mean in general, a lot of people, they just say like, okay, the Prophet ﷺ did this, the Prophet ﷺ did that, or yeah, this is how you should do it, without questioning it, because they got it from where? From their masjid, or from their mosque, or from their, I don't know where, like cultural center, it depends where you live. And I think this is like a major problem, that she would say like she has to be back to the roots, and the only way she's back to the roots is like she was asking her mom. And I had like a lot of thoughts. I really had a lot of thoughts on that. But yeah, and I was kind of shocked when I saw the different reactions. People had different points of view, which is perfectly fine, but how some people were completely changing their perspective, kind of also attacking other people when they see it from a different perspective. And that scared me a little bit. So that the people, like Muslims in general, are not open to other opinions, which are completely valid according to different Islamic laws or points of view. That there's not just one, that this is the only thing you have to do and this is fine, everything else is bad. It's like you have a big choice among, not just among the different mezhabs, or like the different, I don't even know how to say that non-Arabic word, but
schools of law.
Schools of law, yeah, and different schools of law. It's not about that you have like in different schools of law, you have already different perspectives on the same topic, but Islam doesn't just exist on the schools of law. It has like even different, you have Sunni, you have Shia, you have this kind of, so there is not just one thing, and plus culture is cultural aspects, so it's not that easy. And I think of course she couldn't know that, or maybe she could, but it's also not her job, but she should have been a little bit more careful. Mm-hmm. This is my
opinion. I mean, we'll get to you just based Abla real quick, or not quick. Take your time.
Oh, that's okay. I kind of picked up some more information about what all of us here think, and it's really good. And yeah, to the point of Esma admiring that first courage and saying just like, hey, I'm quitting modeling since it's not like, it doesn't represent my values. I totally respect that as a woman. I got myself asked for several model jobs, and I always kind of left them, and I didn't want to do them since I couldn't trust them, and I couldn't trust them with my modesty. So I totally get that and understand that. My only issue with her statements, or in her stories, were that the statements weren't really going along with the pictures. So there was just a sense of confusion in me. So, and as I go through her slides, it's just, in the first slide, she just showed a photo shoot of Fenty, and she wore a black headscarf, and she stated, I felt comfortable, like this was me. And then in the next picture, kind of, I remember she had a red scarf, which she was also fully covered. And she said, just like, oh, I started compromising. So, and I said, okay, oh, it's the color that she's talking about. And then there were different slides where she just had like her head covered with a black turban and you could see her neck. And she said, no. And I said, okay, probably it's the neck. And then, you go further and then she has like a beige headscarf and then she says, oh, this is me. So I was just like, oh, it's not about color again. So what is it exactly? So I couldn't even understand her. I mean, and the issue as well was that in the beginning she stated it was personal. It's a personal niqab journey and hijab journey. And she wanted to point that out. But in the end, or when you go to the middle of the stories, it feels kind of normative. It doesn't feel very personal anymore because she amplifies her ideas to the world and she has 1.4 million followers. And I think it should be a little bit more considered how you kind of represent what into the media.
Thank you, Beyza. So we can go on. I mean, you want to tell us something?
Leute, nur die Verbindung hat kurz abgebrochen, damit ihr Bescheid ist. Just that you know, the connection was interrupted for me for like 30 seconds.
Okay, I'm gonna note the time and cut it out.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Like, I would like to add on what Beyza and Esma actually and what Senadin said. These were all really good points and points that I also shared. And I just want to add to the point, like, that I was confused that so many people kept claiming, okay, this was clearly a personal journey. While I absolutely didn't find the language to be personal, if you say like, this shoot is not for a hijabi, not every shoot is for a hijabi, and you're, for example, in a picture where you're fully covered, where you're wearing white clothes, you're making a normative judgment on how a hijabi should look like. It's not like, yes, this is not a photo shoot for hijabi like me, or this is not how I see hijab. And I was surprised that so many people kept claiming and were so trying to convince me about that this is clearly personal, while we also saw the slides. She was saying, for example, not every shoot is for a hijabi. This also encloses the idea that she knows how a hijabi should dress. Or for example, like, I will never wear my headscarf in a style to show off a necklace. I'm a hijab wearing woman. I can wear rings and bracelets, but what should I wear a necklace for? I know this classical opinion. It's a very classical opinion we can find in many medieval and early sources where it's stated that there's certain areas where jewelry is worn that they should be covered too. And for example, like, you shouldn't see the parts where your earrings are put on, or you shouldn't wear a neck. Or if you wear a necklace around your neck, you should cover it with a scarf, etc. I understand where those opinions coming from, but they're not any more personal. It's a clear preference in a field where we have such a rich tradition on opinion. What I find so disturbing is that Muslims are arguing now, okay, yeah, we're having different norms. We get there is ambiguity of opinion, but we have an Islamic law, which is shocking. Like, if you really dig into Islamic law, and I mean, I have studying this topic specifically for almost 6-7 years, and I know there is a discourse in traditional Islamic law, which is so disconnected to our realities. And there's no acknowledgement of the fact that Muslim women and Muslim men nowadays often completely define the purpose of hijab, or even the term hijab. Like, there were different terms used for head covering, etc. There were terms like khimar, etc. So there was such a situation of so many opinions. And it's fascinating to me to see that people are arguing with Islamic law while often not incorporating opinion of classical Islamic law into their interpretation of hijab. For example, if we look into medieval sources, and I would say like over 98% of Muslim scholars like share the opinion that slave women shouldn't cover their head and that they have the same aura as men, and that they're allowed to show, for example, their collar and their breasts and their legs, etc., up to the knees, which is opinion nobody today, if you ask almost, I think it will be very difficult to find a Muslim woman nowadays saying, okay, I wear the headscarf to differentiate myself from slave woman and from woman of the Jahiliyyah. Like, but that's a classical opinion. Or, for example, if you look into classical sources, you often have the opinion that niqab is a valid option. While today, most Muslims in the world, especially in the Western world, they refuse the idea of wearing niqab. So this reference to tradition, it's so scary to me to see that we're referencing something without actually digging into the topic itself. And I find this very problematic in this context to make a normative judgment while we have a situation which is so ambiguous. And I believe this also completely counteracts God's plan. If God wanted everything to be so clear, he could have stated it clearer, in my opinion. And there is a certain form of flexibility. And I don't think we're doing us ourselves as Muslims, especially living in the Western Hemisphere, a favor if we're succumbing to the idea of one monolithic entity of Islamic law, which was never existent in history, and completely are delusional. And I think this is happening a lot when we are seeing people making very normative judgments and completely refusing any criticism by saying, yeah, but there is still a Islamic law, while not knowing about that Islamic law and not knowing about all the trends in Islamic history of thought we're having. I mean, like the history of Islamic thought isn't just limited by what happened in the pre-modern time. We have also new opinions. We have historical critical approaches. And I find it sad that we are not creating and nurturing a culture as Muslims where we can discuss about things before directly relating itself to ourselves. And what's another problematic figure is, and we witnessed it in certain discussions where we have been attending, that people were stating stuff like, yeah, but like, don't attack Halima now. She had it so difficult. She's coming up with a personal journey, with a personal struggle. I get it. And I find it great. And we need to have modeling contracts for women who say, okay, I want to stick to certain ethical standards. I don't want to show, I don't want to wear tight clothes around the breast area. I don't want to show my neck completely legit. We already have in the fashion industry. I know friends, for example, who are in the fashion industry and say they don't want to do bikini shoes, they don't want to wear mini skirts, and it's already in their contracts. That's a super important discussion to have because it adds to the autonomy of bodily autonomy of Muslim women. But still, the issue is you're a public figure, and I can't treat you like an, I don't know, activist who has 1 or 2,000 followers and is already now having an emotional outburst, and you say, okay, like she's going through depression, she's processing trauma. Let's not go on that road. Let's just forget about it. Let's forgive, because Halima, like, we're all now talking about privilege, but in the end, Halima has a net worth, just like I googled it, like about over a million. She has 1.3 million followers. And we should not criticize her. And there I realized there's something happening, which I would call like selective alliance, because you're saying, okay, you can relate yourself. For example, like you say, like, I'm belonging to a minority. I define myself as a person of color. I grew up in lower societal classes, etc. So I can identify myself with her. But that identification shouldn't obfuscate your idea of when a language is applied, which is maybe not right. Because, for example, there are Muslim women who completely like cut with a certain traditional lifestyle and now saying like, oh, hijab, it's oppression. All those norms of oppression there in public. And they're having also traumatic situations, but we're not showing that kind of understanding. We're bashing those figures, those called in Germany Islam Kritikerinnen, like Nejla Kelek, Seyran Atish, etc. Everyone is so critical of them. And it's okay to be critical of them, but then be critical of everyone else. Because I consider it especially a Quranic imperative to be just. And when you're just, you need to identify injustice wherever it's happening. And when you're a societal figure and a huge social player and exposing your and putting your opinion into the public, then you're also exposed to the criticism. I'm sorry, like, you need to deal with it. And considering the fact that people are, like, in discussion we were, for example, attending, Erva, you were criticized for, like, saying certain expressions and criticizing the way she was formulating her criticism, not maybe in the most perfect language, but like I saw a shift, like what happened, like there was directly people jumped because the identification with Halima's side of the story, they jumped to defending her by saying like, well, we shouldn't criticize her trauma, etc. But what about your trauma you're voicing in the room? So there's happening something in this discourse of privilege and justice, etc., where actually huge societal player with huge influence are completely cut off from any criticism, while people like who are normal and don't have this privilege are super criticized. So there's a lot of paradoxy going on, and to dismantle that is very, very nerve-wracking and time-consuming. But I'm glad to have the chance to do it with you guys, because the conversations we had in the last weeks, they were so enriching for me personally, because we saw like how complex the whole situation is. And look at us, we already have so many conversations in advance of this conversation, and we still come across with new arguments.
Yes, it's wonderful to see. You want to say?
I can imagine why people don't criticize her. It's because, like, to be honest, my first impression was like, wow, she's so strong. I can imagine that the fashion industry is really toxic, and she shares her journey and she's sharing her faults, and like she criticized the fashion industry. But then I saw the next slides where she's talking about the hijab and no, not like this. And yes, this is the right hijab. And I think many people don't criticize her because they were like, no, the fashion industry is so toxic and she speaks about it. We can be like grateful that she's talking about it and sharing this journey. You know what I mean?
Yes, I can completely agree, because she is a big role model for a lot of young women, especially like hijab wearing or black women. And she had a really good and positive influence, I think, on their self, like, image and self-worth and stuff like that. And I always have admired her for her boldness, and even speaking about this was really brave, I think. Then I just, the deeper I got into that story of her, I felt a bit excluded. And that was my main issue with that, because of the way I'm wearing hijab, which is for me personally completely right, and I feel like comfortable with it, and I think it's like religiously justifiable. And then she pointed out, this is good, this is not good. And the first day I couldn't really put my finger on it, what it was that didn't sit right with me. But then after talking to Armin, I was like, yes, you're right, it's so exclusive. And I felt alienated by the way she was like talking so directly, because it was like really like a black and white, and this is it and this is not it. And me like already having experienced like discrimination in my own community, or like, not discrimination, but because of the way I wear hijab, it's all like often looked down, like they often look down on me and criticize me for the way I'm wearing it. Like even publicly and in front of other people, and that's not how the way you do it, but it's fine, I can deal with it. But I already experienced that kind of situation, and then on top of that, like a public figure was such an impact on like the media and like the public people. She states stuff like that, it really felt me, like make me feel uncomfortable in my own skin, just like reflected the whole like toxic structures in like the Muslim community, like even here in my hometown, which we have. And as you can see, we are really touching on really like a lot of subjects here, different topics were mentioned already. And after like you, for the listeners now, everybody got an idea where we're coming from, what our ideas and like what we think. I would just open up the whole discussion and encourage you guys to just start talking with each other, and then tell us what you think, what's like other concerns you have. And I think Esma, did you just raise your hand?
Essentially when you said that you felt alienated by reading her stories, and then somebody, usually the argument would go like, well, Adwa, that's your issue. We know what the Islamic principle says. We know what hijab looks like. Honey, you're a deviation, and deal with it in your own within the four walls. It's not like somebody has to think about your emotions. And on that note, I believe there's a general assumption that Muslim women who decide to wear the headscarf in an unconventional manner, or decide not to wear one at all, are somehow of deficient, weak faith. Well, for some, it might be that sort of struggle, which we all have naturally for different ordinances. There are simply Muslim women who consciously choose different interpretations, applications of the concept of hijab, including the one where the headscarf itself is excluded. These choices for some women, including myself, are theologically based and are not a sign of us being somehow less devoted to Islam or having a weak connection to Allah, nor is it a symptom of apologetic conformity to some Western values, a sign of surrendering under such social pressures, etc., etc. So for some of us, or perhaps even many of us, it's a conscious choice aligned with the principle of hijab and made in peace with and in the name of Allah. Now, put aside the ethical principle of Islam, which should be like to actually be very considerate about anyone's feelings, regardless of how mm-hmm. deviant they are from the norm. But in this case, we're not talking about a deviation at all. But it's something that I, as a language freak, I mean, I'm a linguist, so I look at it from not from a theological, but nearly purely theological, in the sense that, for example, Armin can. But I'm looking at it from the point of discourse, and I believe we need to have a discursive shift in the Muslim community so that we stop having these depersonalized authorities that we refer to when talking about Islamic ordinances, laws, etc. This is something that I noticed in the Bosnian Muslim community when I recently did my research. I conducted a critical analysis of the discourse about Muslim women in our community, and I realized that one of the most one of the recurring patterns was that arguments related to something being an Islamic ordinance, when people wanted to say that something is how it should be in Islam, they usually referred to these depersonalized, impersonal authorities of, quote unquote, this is what Islam says, like Islam as a fixed entity. This is what they say, they being theologians. So I did not find a single instance in all of the discourses I analyzed of people saying, well, this is what this and this specific authority, theologian, et cetera, says. This is what this school of thought says. But this is what Islam says. There were even constructs such as true Islam, meaning that usually in opposition to some new ideas and theories, saying like, well, but that's not true Islam, et cetera, et cetera. So I realized that this is a very dangerous phenomenon in our community, that people are not being, I wouldn't say but that authorities are not being held accountable, but that's also an issue. But the fact that we are not aware of the inclusivity and plurality of the theological corpus of Islam is, I think, a very dangerous thing, because that is what creates a very strong obstacle for our progress toward becoming a more inclusive and egalitarian and just must become. I mean, it's a must. We have some principles that have to be overarching imperatives that are to follow, and in order to achieve that, we need to be aware of the plurality of the thoughts. So
period. I want to stress this sentence out. It's so important what you just said. Yes.
As a linguist, I would say, just in case somebody wants to add something smarter. So
no, also when you think about the educational part, the things that she puts out of there, first of all, you really feel confusion. Like, that's what I felt, because I didn't know what she wasn't clear about the images, what she even likes, but then she speaks as she was clear. So that was really confusing for me. I was like pointing my head to the left and saying, it's like, huh? What does she mean by that? And probably, and if you consider also the people that are following her, young people, young Muslim women that wear or wear not hijab, doesn't matter, they probably also felt confusion, or they also might felt this courage of pursuing a modeling career even. So, of course, she stated that it's personal, but in the end, she made very clear normative statements, which she shouldn't have. I just wish she should have known the media better, and she could just stated, oh, you know, guys, I decided to leave the modeling industry. It was really toxic. How do you say that? The thing when you bend your own rules.
Compromise?
Where you have to. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that didn't come to mind. Like, I had to compromise on so many levels that I left it, and I'm now seeking myself and my true self, and I want to be, mm-hmm. you know, I want to be good with myself. I want to have a good conscience about who I am. So, and that everybody would have understand, like, nobody had to go into the hijab discourse anyway, because as she said as well, like, it's a very personal thing, but why do you state so clear statements as if you know what you're really talking about? And when you also go into history and look at hijab and how women wore it with a lot of, like, internationally, even in England, people wore hijab, you know, in Christianity, there is also a type of hijab they wear. And if you look at it, it was also always the culture formed it. It was a very fluid thing. It changed over time. So there was actually not a clear picture of how a hijab should look. And it was just a little bit out of the point when she was just saying that, oh, it should look like that. And that's literally the only problem, not her leaving the modeling or... Not her
absolutely
doing what she's doing in her life.
Yes,
so.
Nadine.
So yeah, my question is just like, where does this come from? I mean, she didn't study Islamic theology. She is a model. I don't know if she's still modeling or did she just quit for part time. I didn't figure out that. But anyways, even if she decides to go ahead, I mean, it's her job. It's her passion, she likes it, but if it's my passion, if it's my job, if it's my duty or whatever kind of profession this person has, in her case, it's modeling, don't expect to deepen your faith in this job. I mean, it's a job. I also don't expect in my job to get get closer to Allah in my daily life. I mean, this is like something personal. Don't expect it from your job. It depends, of course, on the job, but it's modeling and it's completely fine, you know? That's one thing. But my question is, where does this opinion of hers come from? Obviously she got it, like, maybe from her parents, from her household, or from the masjid she went to. So from somewhere, this point of view, like, this has to be like this and this doesn't have to be like that. It's not allowed to be like that. This normative kind of thinking has to come from somewhere. And this reminds me of one of my close friends who studied or who was trying to study Islamic theology in four different countries, in four different institutes. And he said all of them, they were like more classical or like classical or traditional institutes. I think that's the word you told me once. This is the term for that. All of these institutes claimed to have the right Islam and claim to have, like, this is Islam, how it should be. All the others are not good.
They're deficient.
I don't know. Exactly. All of them. And they were like completely different institutes, like on three different continents. So I think this is the main issue. If you go to a masjid or if you go to in any mosque or cultural center, for example, here in Germany, you have more cultural centers than like proper mosques, like in more like in Muslim or Muslim countries. They have like this already formed opinion, and if you don't obey this opinion, you're lost, kind of, or you're going to kind of like exclude it. Same thing, it's for your hijab as well, you know. So when you say like people judge you if you don't wear like on a certain way or whatever, so. I think this is the point of my problem. Where does this come from? Why? When did that happen? Because if you read like history, like this, the Muslim history, it was so open. There were a lot, I think a billion times more open-minded than the people nowadays. So they were completely open-minded in terms of like sex or nationalism that didn't kind of exist back then. So like a lot of other facts, or a lot of others, the people were more open-minded. And so when did this change happen? And why did it happen? Who did that? This is what I'm thinking. Like, what is the source of this kind of normative thinking, which she like had? I mean, like, I don't blame her, because I have it in my daily life as well. And just kind of like, sometimes when I hear other opinions, I'm not aware, oh my God. So I was judgmental, or I thought this is the right thing, but I didn't know. So it's kind of like a process for all of us, that we have to educate ourselves and be like, not stubborn and like narrow-minded, to accept other opinions.
You raised so many questions. I don't know where to start to respond to you, Sanadin. Like, first of all, I share your your first observation with the issues we have in the Muslim community, with the lack of acknowledgement of ambiguity, the lack of openness in certain fields of discussion. I completely agree with it. I think one issue is how our religious education nowadays functions in mosques. It's usually delivered through, I mean, like we know it in the Bosnian and the Turkish context, ilmihal, which is kind of catechism, a summary of religious doctrine. You learn certain surahs, you learn this is haram halal, or some anashid, and that's it. You're over it, kind of. And then you need to be expected to operate within a certain set of norms. And if you deviate a little from it, you start being a problem. You're starting being a problem, and you directly get associated with a lack of iman or a lack of modesty, etc. Yes. And like, we're not aware how rich the tradition is in like opinions we're taking on as premises. For example, I heard so often the statement like, oh, I think my iman decreased. But for example, if you follow Abu Hanifa's definition of iman, he says like, iman can't decrease and increase. Either you have it or you don't. Either you're a believer or you're a disbeliever. So for example, when we follow Abu Hanifa's definition, we couldn't, for example, even use this definition. And then you see like, for example, in Bosnian mosques, how they talk about decreasing and increasing of Islam. And then in the constitution of the Bosnian Islamic community, it's written that Islam in Bosnia is based on the Aqidah school of Maturidi. But in real life, it's so often like based on Ash'ari, actually. Then they say
can you quickly explain those two terms and words, maybe? Not everybody's Aqidah familiar with it.
Are schools of thought in terms of they're asking not necessarily questions that are related to law, but questions that are related to belief. For example, what is disbelief? What is belief? How one gets into heaven? How one does not get into heaven? Those kind of questions, like on a metasphere, is what schools of thought, so-called Aqidah schools, are asking themselves. But for example, when it comes to schools of law, so often, for example, when it comes to the Adhan in Bosnia, like it should have been a little bit later if it will be according to the definition of Abu Hanifa. But they're following the Shafi and the Maliki and Hanbali tradition, but they're presenting themselves of preserving a clear and pure, you know, like untouched Hanafi Islam, which is so paradox. And it's so fascinating to see that even those people who should operate within those framework deviate, but there's absolutely no sense of it, because everyone believes they have the prerogative of Islam. They know they have the monopoly of interpretation, and they know what's going on. And this is like clearly an issue related to epistemic humbleness. And I think what every good scholar should have, and what I see lacking with so many scholars, either in mosque context or even in university context, is like, you should be aware why you get to a certain opinion. I mean, socialization, the religious context. Have you been in a Ahmadiyya context? Have you been in a liberal context? In a more traditional context, Sunni context? I mean, like, this influences and shapes our perception when we go into the Quran, when we go into the Sunnah, when we go into the sources. What experience have I made? I mean, like, someone, for example, who grew up in a household where, for example, the mother was a kick-ass feminist who was demonstrating for female rights, and she has a PhD. I assume that a person who grew up in such a context will be more likely when, for example, like facing certain verses that could be interpreted in a misogynist way, to contextualize them or to try to take an alternative opinion or a different reading. While someone who grew up in a very patriarchal setting somewhere else in the world, or even in the Western Hemisphere, it doesn't matter, like will take this opinion. I think a good scholar should be aware why you constitute your opinions, what are the impacts that influence you, and then you come to opinion, but you still say in the end, as scholars in classical terms, it's Allahu Alam. Allah knows it better. So you, it's okay to state an opinion, but you should leave the space and acknowledge that maybe another opinion could be right. But I see this kind of like, this is what is lacking. Like the acknowledgement that their own personal opinion is limited and everyone is acting like they get it. And it's super problematic for Muslim women. And what I generally noticed, like we have talked, actually, I think yesterday we talked about it, Erva. I asked the question like, because often I get this argument like, hey, don't intervene in those discussions. Muslim women already have them among themselves. And stating like, okay, we already have this discourse on women shouldn't discriminate women. But actually, with almost all the women I talked, and including you, Erva, they said like, we don't have this discourses. And there's even among women who wear hijab or don't wear hijab, this opinion like, you're dressed wrong, you're dressed right. And why people ask me like, okay, why is it so important for you to intervene into this sphere, is because I believe it's toxic for Muslim women as it's toxic for men. It's toxic for men because it gives them certain legitimation to rule over Muslim women, claim certain rights on their bodies and believe that they got how they should wear it and actually go to them and say it. But especially what I found traumatizing were, I think, two situations I experienced while studying Islamic theology. One was actually my first term, where we were sitting in the classroom, and a woman approached actually a friend of mine and said like, listen, like, I noticed how you wear your hijab. It's not quite Islamic. It's wrong, etc. And then she started pulling her hijab so you couldn't see any of her neck, etc. And this girl was so traumatized and she couldn't say like, stop. And none of us said like, hey, stop. Not even me. Like, I was in first term. We were just like, okay, she's weird. And then what I find highly disturbing is actually there was a girl. She was wearing himar. This is kind of a long dress which covers the complete upper body and is also often like attached to a certain skirt, which is also very wide, and she was wearing it. And then she came to university into the Arabic class wearing jeans, a blazer, a long blouse and a headscarf. And the tutor actually was shocked because she was wearing the kind of himar style and she thought like, okay, we're bonding based on our clothes. And she went actually to guys in the course and said like, okay, guys, do you know what's happening with her? Is she maybe falling in love? Is she maybe attached to a guy too much and does that for the guy? And then this girl found out that her tutor was talking behind her back. This was super traumatizing and distressing with her. Then the tutor was crying and there was a huge conflict and she couldn't attend any more of the Arabic classes. And was saying, I don't feel comfortable. And that girl actually quit Islamic, I mean, what means girl? That woman quit Islamic theology. And these were things I was witnessing. So I believe like we understand Islam holistically, we can divide this. Okay, this is just something that will be discussed among women. This is something that will be just discussed among men, because there are Quranic verses that talk about women and men, like in terms of polarity, like day and night. What the being and the existence of one cannot be without the other. And you know, so like these topics are related in a certain way, and we can't just completely like believe like that, and this is a very modern phenomenon, believe these are topics for men and these are topics for women, because especially it's interesting to see that Muslim women very often say like, okay, Muslim men shouldn't have a say in this topics, while the norms, for example, that were made for Muslim women, and for example, like decisions like, can a woman be a prophet, can a woman not be a prophet, how should the hijab be worn, these were majorly made by men. So it's paradox to me to say like, you're completely disconnecting yourself from any male perspective, while the opinions you are incorporating in your daily religious lives were mainly made by men, and it's so paradox on so many levels. But I believe it's with time there will happen a lot of change, and especially in the Western Hemisphere where we have certain freedoms to discuss topics without having an institution that will shut us down or a dictatorship that will completely, how you say, like silence us and suppress us. I believe there is a lot of chance, but I'm finding it kind of distressing to see that young Muslim academics are so woke when it comes to political theories, sociological theories, and so critical. We're not taking this whitewash concept. Oh, this is from colonialism. This is from the West. But when it comes to religion, it's so dogmatic. it's so one-dimensional. And I ask myself, like, how is this still standing, this kind of system? And I mean, like, there are so many explanations for it, but maybe this is a topic for another episode. I think this is more of an observation, but we see there's a lot of work to do. And I believe it takes, it's not just for theologians. We need sociologists, we need pedagogues, we need people from so many disciplines to shed different perspectives on Islam and Islamic practice. And I'm so happy that kind of you guys, that guys like you exist who are so open-minded, etc. And I found the conversations in the last week so refreshing. While I was like thinking, like, this is it, like, you brought me kind of back, and I'm so thankful for having you guys. Seriously, I am.
Aww.
Thank you. I'm tearing up. Yes, Esma,
yeah,
please.
I would just like to add on this part where you said that where you discussed the exclusion of men from this from these discussions. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that because of the fact that we have had Muslim men's opinion all the time about the way we should look like and behave and what should we believe in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're kind of, we've had enough of policing from men's side. Let's be three.
Enough of that. Kind of.
But the problem is, here's the catch 22. So the problem is that imams are still exclusively male. I mean, there is this teeny tiny percentage non-male imams, but those are deviations. Mm-hmm. So the thing is that we need to understand that when somebody is canceling men from these discussions, I think it's mostly when we believe that those are men who do not come from serious theological backgrounds and randomly impose their opinions on the way I should look like. So thank you very much, but your opinion... Yes. Is none of my business at this point. Are you a theologian? You're not. Mm-hmm. So, sorry.
We canceling
kind
your
of
opinion.
Canceling, yeah. So, but in your case, of course, it's a different story. So I understand your point of view, but we cannot ignore the fact that it's a lot of Muslim men who have nothing to do with theology, who often are very uneducated about Islam, who make the strongest mm-hmm. statements about how we should look like. And that is something that has to stop.
But also uneducated women do the same with other women.
Yes.
I can probably write a book on how women taught me to be mm-hmm. as a mm-hmm. woman, or when I went to a mosque learning the Quran, I was kind of very active, sporty girl, and I got told to behave more like a girl, that I'm not like a girl, or... but in school, on the other side, the teacher just told my mom, just like, oh, just make her like do some sports after school so she gets that energy out. So she's very, you know, she's very kinesthetic. So she works bodily. So, yeah, but it's the perception onto women are kind of really heavy, especially on young girls. And there's a big world out of there that we have to scramble down and build it new, mm-hmm. I think. Especially, and I always believe and say this, Islam is not traditional. Islam is revolutionary. All the prophets, they were revolutionary. They were activists. They changed the whole structure of one society or many societies. And I think that's the fault of Muslim societies, that they just stay in one specific way and not evolve. So I think we have to evolve. We are human beings. I think Allah created us to just evolve continuously. Preach. So, yeah.
You're right. I just want to go back to Senadin's question. You asked from where did her decision came from? And I think she mentioned her mother so often, and her mother, like, is her role model. And she posted, like, you have to hear our mothers, they are right. And I was like, oh my God, you just got brainwashed from your mother. I don't want to sound mean now, but I think many people know this Fatima, that you can, like, you move out from home and you develop yourself or your personality, and then you go back, you visit your mom now during Corona, and she is like,
you do this wrong, you do this wrong, and you did this wrong, and everything wrong. So I can imagine that Halima was like 24 hours with her mother, and she. What do you think?
Well, I'm not blaming Halima for this, because again, this is like a structural problem. Because
of course,
all we hear like growing up is, don't talk back to your parents, don't talk ill to your parents, like about your parents and all that. And we are brought up to accept everything from our parents without like questioning it.
Yeah,
and that really leads us to behave in a really abusive, like, to shut down all these discussions and all the dialogues about this, because everybody's afraid to say something, because these are really like toxic characteristics we all experienced, I think, being exposed to like similar family issues. And we also, as a Muslim community or growing up Muslim, we have to break down these stigmas and like these taboos and this like really negative connotation about like you can talk back to your parent like in a really like well-behaved way. If you have respect, you can tell them if something is wrong or if they behaved in a wrong way, and you don't have to accept everything they do to you, because they're just human beings too, right? Yeah. Yeah. Nobody's perfect, and I don't blame anyone for this, but you should reflect on things happening in your own family and be allowed to talk about it even publicly. Like, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not demonizing her mom.
No, absolutely not. No,
none of us.
I'm sure her mom had the best.
She's also doing the best. Yes. She's doing the best. Yes. She had the best intentions, and which is completely fine. But as you already mentioned, like as you said, this is completely. I'm completely with you. It depends. Depends on the background. Mm-hmm. I mean, she grew up somewhere with
Minnesota,
U.S.
In the Somali community.
Okay.
She also is
in the Somali community. So
she also is Miss Minnesota, I think. She won that prize. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Wow. Cool. Congrats.
Halima, if you ever listen to this, congrats.
If you're ever listening to this, like, just follow it.
Don't be angry. I'm not sorry.
And we love you. It's okay. We don't.
We all love you. Really, we do. Yeah, but we still have to criticize the girl.
Yeah, we do. We do. Exactly. It's about, this is exactly the fact. Criticism doesn't mean that we are canceling.
Definitely.
You are like a completely bad person. It's just, everyone is a human being. We have good parts. We have bad parts. We do a lot of things right, but we also do a lot of things wrong. And same thing counts for her mom. She had like the best intention, and she did that how she grew up with her, the knowledge she had from I don't know where. And when I think, for example, in case of my parents, I mean, my parents had to flee a war. They saw traumatizing things. Of course, I have to question some things, how they try to educate me and my siblings. Like, I mean, afterwards, as a child, you can't, obviously, but afterwards, when I'm gonna have kids, or when we're gonna have kids, I also
when you say we, people don't see you. You have to say who.
Me and my wife, like she, who's
I'm very Beza. That's the wife.
Oh yeah, just for clarification.
Both of us, when I'm gonna have kids one day, of course I want to try to do my best, and of course I also want to check. Okay, how did my parents do that? Was it good? Was it bad? Of course I have to question those things because of the traumas they had or whatever. And I think that should count for like the knowledge she received from her parents, like Islamic, like, you know, this time in this point is like from the Islamic point of view, you have to question things. I mean, isn't it like the first verse was Iqra, which means read?
Yes. So
why don't we read? Mm-hmm. Why don't just we, someone says, yeah, the Prophet Sassam did this and that. Okay, good. Then now I'm going to preach it without even questioning if it's right or not. So I think that's the that's the biggest problem, especially for the different styles of hijab. I mean, the people, the women in Bosnia wear the hijab completely differently than the Somali women or the women in Malaysia or the women I don't know where, you know? So without knowing that, you just give some random answers, you know?
And did you see her DMs? Like, she shared a little bit how she's criticizing her manager or something like this, and she was like, why didn't you remember me to call my mother, or why did you, like, I didn't pray on time, and she's bashing her manager. And I would, like, if I would be a white manager in the fashion industry, I would be afraid to call another hijabi girl now because I have now a bad experience. And I think, like, Halima is the biggest model, hijabi model, but there are enough other, like, hijabi blogger, and they working in this fashion industry. And I think now the fashion industry is a little bit traumatized because she exposed them all, and now they're afraid.
Which is a good thing. I think white managers should become more aware of what they do.
Yes, so, of course. But, like, you can't bash them because you didn't call your mother.
You're still personally responsible for yourself. I think what she does by that is she's depriving herself of personal agency. Every one of us is responsible for their own prayer, and we can't expect somebody running after us and taking care of our hereafter. Yes. What I find very problematic is this general idea, and I mean, we all saw it in the Muslim community, that we're equating the way our parents are thinking on the world, not just on Islam, in general in the world, with that's how it should be. I mean, like, we already find this criticism in the Quran, where it's criticized that people say we are following the belief of our forefathers blindly. No. You should take your own brain and you should work it out. Like, start thinking, start reflecting, like, use those brain cells. Girl, boy, seriously. And that's very problematic. And I think like that parents try to give their kids a good, not just a bad conscience, they try to oppress their kids and send them in a clear direction by saying, like, I will, for example, not forgive you this on the day of judgment. If you don't this, you don't have my approval, etc. Which is so problematic.
It's guilt tripping. Like, for example, at its finest.
On Islamic pedagogy, our teacher was telling us a story where a son wanted to where a kid wanted to pursue a certain career and go to this because his father was saying to him, if you start doing this and if you take this job opportunity, we will see each other in the next world. And that kid completely succumbed to this idea of the father by believing I need to obey to my parents. And that's theologically so, so problematic. And I see it so often in the Muslim community. And I believe that Halima, it's something which is already part of our communities. And I don't believe she was doing anything abnormal and anything unusual. Mm-hmm. It's just a reminder on us how we easily get manipulated by subjectivities of our parents, and we equate them with the right path. And I think that's something, like, there comes theological reflection into it. And I think like what we have in general in the whole Muslim education system, our imams and scholars aren't telling us, use your own brain cells, start forming your opinions, start being brave, go into the text. No, like, still, like, you should, you know, and that's, we don't even have mostly, like, in many Muslim families, starting from my wider family, in my closer family, I have it, but going to visit more far related relatives, like, when I was speaking up, it was a no-go. It was like, who are you as a younger to save an opinion? Even as somebody, like, who studied Islamic theology, I wasn't expected to speak on certain issues. It was like, you can have 100 degrees of Islamic theology, you're not about to disagree with me. Like, what, for example, a statement of, I don't want to hear your opinion. Right. And that's this issue we are having. And
not just that. I mean, I think I have the same issue. Like, for example, the job. For example, if you take this job, I'm not going to make you my haq or your halal or whatever. I mean, we hear that a lot of times. Or especially people who, like us, or like, without exceptions, you, Esma, who live abroad, like in a diaspora or whatever, like third culture kids, okay?
if we want to have like an intercultural marriage, for example, in case of me and my wife, she's Turkish, I'm Bosnian. Oh my God, I experienced so much hatred, or like, not like within our family.
It's even from the imam, right?
What?
The imam, can you imagine? I went to the Bosnian mosque, okay? Can you imagine? And typical Bosnian, who are you? And then,
from whom are you? Yeah, yeah, because you're defined over the
top. Yeah.
Almost
from whom are you, okay? Yeah. You are defined, only defined by your relatives or like your ancestors or whatever. Anyways, so blah, blah, we talked, and then, yeah, are you married? What is your job? You wanted to check on me, like typical CIA kind of stuff. So like typical mosque businesses. No, I'm just kidding. And then I said, like, yeah, I'm about to be. That was right before my my wedding. And I don't know. Then the topic came up that my wife is not Bosnian. And then he started like, no, don't do that. We are so completely different. And the culture, and oh, there's so many of them, and they're not, they're just a few of us, and blah blah. And I was like, we're not that different. I mean, we got the religion from the Turks, basically. So how can we be that different? And then I started like, this is not an Islamic point of view you have. I mean, this is contradicts the Islam. Like, we are all human beings.
It's nationalism.
Nationalism. Like, how can it be? Wow. How can you preach that right now? And then he's like, yeah, I know, but, and then he blah, 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 and continued. Wow. And then since then, I've never spoken to this person again. I planned to do the wedding in there because my family, most of my family doesn't live in Germany. Most of the family of my wife's is in Germany. So I wanted to have like, for me, it was important so that my family during the wedding process, they understand. But I found one. He's also married to an Egyptian woman. And he had exactly the same issues. And I think a lot of people listen in this case to their parents like, oh, no, I'm not going to give you, for example, mom says, I'm going to not give you give you my milk halal if you do, if you marry this person. And they just don't do it then. You know, they just obey in this case. And this is, I think, in a lot of terms, but specifically, I got this experience. At the end, everything alhamdulillah went well. So we're happily married and stuff. But it was a process, mm-hmm. basically.
And that raises in the end the question, like, issues. If that is your understanding of religion, what is the empowering and liberating element of religion? If in the end it goes all to your parents and you can't think with your own head and you can't stand up for yourself and do the actions you think, pursue the actions you think are right. Like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Baba, I want to buy a car. Which color should it be?
So I think we slowly reached the end of this episode. I can say yes, you're all nodding. Okay, that's awesome. But before like stopping to record, please bear with me. My English is
it's late. It's late. Don't worry.
I just wonder, like, real, like, last statement from everyone, and like your thoughts about the whole process. Maybe like okay, Esma, will you start?
Oh, why me? Okay, so I would just summarize some of the points that I made, and I think that the most important thing that we should consider as Muslims is that, yeah, in order for our community to progress toward what it should be, and that is a just, egalitarian, inclusive community that respects people's liberties and rights, that puts people's dignity as a priority, that does not try to avoid to inflict pain and any kind of suffering on its constituents. We need to revise these kind of exclusive practices, thinking that somebody has a deficient iman simply because they have a different theologically based point of view, practice, etc., etc. Otherwise, I think the evolution that Beza mentioned, that Allah created us for, is definitely hindered.
Thanks. Who's next? Yes,
Go ahead.
I just want to add that for the listeners, if you ever doubt on something that you have asked and got an answer for, and your heart says, like, I don't like this answer, or you don't know where it's coming from, literally just do yourself a good research. And then if your heart kind of applies to that and says, like, oh yeah, this is for me, then do it. Be crystal clear on the things that you want to do. And if you're not, then just leave it, and maybe leave it for 3 or 4 more years when you have a little bit more experience, and then you can go back to that question and ask it again, and maybe then you find an answer. I think this is the best way to find the right way for yourself, and also
thanks, it's some really good advice. Yes, Armin, please.
Definitely, I would like to add on what Esma and Beza have said, like, be open to reflect, because like, we're all human beings and we have the right also to doubt. And I think it's important to give ourselves the space. And I know from studying Islamic theology, like most of my friends who have also studied theology, there is a period when you're confronted with so many opinions and you're thinking yourself like, why do I have now 10 opinions on the subjects? What is wrong? Like every time a new opinion, I can't anymore. And I believe like the first time you start like deconstructing your understanding of religion, it can be a very confusing time. But to end it with the words of a professor who said, like, the first sip out of the glass of science might lead to a confusion of in terms of religion, but on the ground of that glass lies the reality of God. And be open to read, because if you believe your iman is too weak when you start questioning, then you have to ask yourself, what kind of iman do you have? And I think we should be more brave, and we should also be encouraging of people not always being on the same line with ourselves, and especially in the climate we are all involved in, those bubbles, political activists, like in these kind of arenas, like there's this exclusive culture and where people are very often canceled and even like severely attacked when they don't know a certain term. And I think we have to allow ourselves to grow and allow also others to grow. And I think that's the final message I would like to say, have to say, to have understanding, and also not to equate criticism with hate or neglect, etc. Because all of us, like, we highly appreciate what Halima did. We highly appreciate her courage. We acknowledge the valid point she made. But out of love, I would say, all of us, out of love for our Muslim community and the things we believe Islam stands for, we're raising our criticism. And I think that's important always to stress, because people very often, they can't understand that you can criticize someone severely, but still see that certain points have validation, because we have this black-white thinking. Either you're with me or you're without me. But let's have a culture where we're with each other with criticizing each other.
That was beautifully said. Yeah.
Thank you.
I see everyone agrees.
Thank you so much.
you have to...
That's pretty hard for me now. To sum up my conclusion. Thank you. Thank all of you.
No pressure, Senadi. No pressure.
Short sentence. No, I don't know what to, I mean, like, it's fine. Thank you for no pressure. No, it's pretty hard to add, because basically all of you already said so much, and I'm completely on your side. But I would just say, like, be compassionate, have empathy, and yeah, reflect and question things. Yeah. That's basically it, because hatred doesn't help anyone.
Neither you nor other people. That's just just be compassionate. If someone does something wrong, just be compassionate. This person has his reason. Same
thing. Yes, love and peace.
Stop judging. Just love and peace. Basically, that's it. And I mean, I think that's more important.
Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah.
Well, this is how I want. How I want to spend my like Friday nights, like talking to like the most cute people on this earth and having like really deep conversations, recording awesome episodes for our podcast. Yeah. Thanks for everybody who like listened and stayed till the end. And I hope you gain something from this conversation. We don't want to leave you on like negative notes. So I hope this summary from everybody was like a really positive note in my opinion. Yeah.
Same.
Trust me, it was all love.
Love.
And we have to end on like a salam together. You know the drill, right? You're going to count to three?
We're going to try. All
right. You're going to be part of it now.
I always wanted to do it.
3, 2, 1. Salam.
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 So, jetzt sind wir am Ende der Folge angelangt und bevor ihr wegklickt, eine letzte Erinnerung, wir sind jetzt auch auf Steady. Ich buchstabiere einmal STEADY. Da sucht ihr einfach gedankensalat.podcast und seid dann auf unserer Seite. Wir würden uns sehr freuen, wenn ihr einmal vorbeischaut.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.